This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've heard some of the gloomy predictions about global warming. Here's one. It's 50 years from now. You're in New York. There's been 30 90-degree days in a row. People are going nuts from the heat. The forests, or what's left of them, are going up in flames from heat and drought. And you can't even go to the beaches because they're covered with green slime. My guest Michael Oppenheimer is one of the scientists sounding the alarm. He's also recommending solutions. Oppenheimer is a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, a national nonprofit environmental advocacy group. He directs their Global Atmosphere Program, focusing on solutions to the global warming problem. He suggests some of the changes we should be making in his new book, Dead Heat: The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. I asked Michael Oppenheimer if this summer's high temperatures are a result of the greenhouse effect.
I think we should take this heat wave as a good analogy for what the future will look like, rather than trying to ascribe it specifically to any long-term global warming pattern. If we don't limit the so-called greenhouse gases, which over the long term will cause a warming of the Earth, then we're going to see more and more summers, like the brutal one that the western part of the United States is suffering through now, and the brutal one that the eastern part of the United States suffered through in 1988, where most of the East Coast cities, for instance, had about twice the number of 90-degree days. The farms in the Midwest experienced a brutal drought, and the barges were stuck on the muddy bottom of the Mississippi because there was so little water. Those are images which should remind us what the future will look like if we don't act soon to stop the growth of the greenhouse effect.
How certain are you as a scientist that the Earth really is heating up as a result of the greenhouse effect?
There are lots of unknowns, but there are a few things that we're certain of. And one of them is this: as long as we keep adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the Earth will warm. Not only that, the Earth is already warmer by about 1 degree Fahrenheit than it was a century ago, and a good deal of that warming is probably due to the growth in greenhouse gases.
What are your predictions for the 21st century if there aren't any changes in the amount of greenhouse gases that are released into the environment?
If we keep going with business as usual, with the emissions of these gases growing, then by early in the next century, Earth will be warmer than any time in the history of the human race, which is basically over 100,000 years. And that's 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And then by the end of the next century, Earth will be about anywhere between 4 and 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And if that doesn't sound like a lot, remember that that brutal summer of 1988, where we had all those 90-degree days, was only on average 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. So relatively small changes in temperature, in the mean temperature, can have very large effects on climate in general. So we'd be looking for radical changes in Earth's climate as the century develops. And these are things that are going to happen in my lifetime, hopefully, in your lifetime, in the lifetimes of our children, certainly.
Well, you have a scenario that you set out in your new book where droughts ravage American farmlands. The farmlands become ghost towns. There's food riots around the world, bringing political repression. The population in America ends up moving north to Canada. Is that just to scare us? Are you serious about
that? No, that's serious. Look, first of all, in smaller scale, all those things happen already. We do have food shortages in many parts of the world already. There are food riots. We have had severe drought in the Midwest, and in the 30s, of course, there was a Dust Bowl, and that did cause people to migrate. What we're looking at for the future, if we don't limit the greenhouse gases, is an intensification of those sorts of things which happen sporadically anyway. Populations will move as agricultural production moves from one region to another. Some regions will get dried out, and there is a good chance that the Midwest will be that sort of region, and therefore there'll be less farm productivity. Sea level will rise, and that will cause populations to shift from places like Bangladesh, the Nile Delta, even southern Louisiana. And where are those people going to go when populations move? There are conflicts. In fact, we're looking at a refugee problem which dwarfs anything we've seen so far from wars and the various depredations that humans sort of wreak on each other. So the future looks grim if we let the climate warming proceed in an unlimited fashion. But the important point to remember is this: it doesn't have to happen.
Michael Oppenheimer is my guest, and he's a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs a program that focuses on solutions to the greenhouse problem. And he's written a book called Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. Before we talk about some of the possible solutions that you've been thinking about, solutions to the greenhouse effect, let's just outline the problem a little bit. If you would just give us a basic reintroduction to the greenhouse effect.
Okay, here it is, quick and dirty.
Yeah.
You know what it feels like when you walk inside a greenhouse? It's warm. The reason it's warm is the glass lets the sunlight through, but it keeps the heat from escaping to the outside. Well, there are certain gases in the atmosphere, particularly carbon dioxide, which comes from burning coal, oil, and natural gas, and from cutting down forests and burning them. Those gases act the same way. They act like the glass of a greenhouse. They're transparent to sunlight, so the sunlight comes through and heats the Earth's surface, but they trap the heat as it tries to radiate back into space. As we build up those gases in the atmosphere, it is inevitable that Earth will get warmer.
You see the end of the Cold War as an opportunity for environmentalism.
And look, people are starting to realize that environmental problems are at the base of national security threats now. The big question for the future is not who'll conk who on the head, the U.S. or the Soviet Union. The big question is, are we going to destroy the ozone layer so that ultraviolet radiation causes a skin cancer epidemic? Are we going to change climate so radically and so rapidly that civilization can't adjust, can't keep up? Those are really the issues for the future that undermine our security. And I think all the nations of the world are turning in that direction. And as a result, I see this as a golden era for the environment in some sense. We have an opportunity to focus resources on that problem that previously went to doing things like building missiles.
Toward the end of June, Sam Nunn, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, proposed shifting substantial Defense Department and intelligence resources to go to ecological problems. And he called for a new program that would retain extensive national security research apparatus at the Pentagon, but turn a lot of its focus into looking at the new national security threat posed by the degradation of the environment. Do you support that, and do you think it goes far enough?
I thought that was a fascinating proposal. Yeah. I'm two-thirds in favor of it. Senator Nunn got two things out of three right. Number one, environmental threats are security threats. Number two, we need to spend a lot more money on finding out about them. Mm-hmm. The thing that he got wrong is to spend that money in the Pentagon or in the Department of Energy. Those are bureaucracies which are not interested in the environment. If we're going to spend a lot more money on environmental research, we ought to set up a new setup. We ought to have what you might call a modern-day Manhattan Project, but not in the Defense Department. Instead of trying to do things to save the money inside the military, to keep the money inside the military, which is what Nunn's proposal is about, we ought to take it out of the military and move it elsewhere where it can do the real job that has to be done.
Last month, there was an international meeting in England that included environment ministers from 93 nations, and they agreed to phase out the production and the use of
chlorofluorocarbons.
Thank you.
CFCs.
Yes, and several other chlorine-based chemicals by the end of the century. What were your impressions of that conference? And I'm interested to know if you think that this is an example of a really new positive international alliance around environmental issues, and if you think that this agreement will be effective in helping to stay the greenhouse effect.
The ozone depletion issue is related to the greenhouse issue in that the chemicals which deplete the ozone layer, chlorofluorocarbons, are also part of the greenhouse problem. They're secondary greenhouse gases. So if we control the chlorofluorocarbons for one purpose, it'll give us a side benefit in helping get the climate problem under control. And yeah, I think that the agreement is a good one. It could have had the whole thing happening a little quicker, but they're going to get rid of these chemicals by about the year 2000. So this is an agreement which, although it's not perfect, does point the way towards future attempts to protect the environment. And in particular, we're looking for a global climate agreement, including all the nations of the world, by about 1992. And we wish the United States would take some leadership there. The U.S., unfortunately, politically is falling behind on these issues.
Sounds great to get rid of CFCs, but, I was just reading a New York Times article that covered the end of the conference, and it said, that the price of phasing out CFCs may include greater electricity consumption, costlier and less reliable refrigeration and automotive products, and increasing public exposure to toxic substances and explosives, and suddenly things start to sound less good,
Well, there are always trade-offs. Nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
But the loss of the ozone layer would mean a skin cancer epidemic of unprecedented proportions. It would have meant eventually skyrocketing death rates due to melanoma. And this is certainly intolerable. And what the agreement, which was originally signed in Montreal in 1987 and then just updated, what that agreement assures is that that industry will start the search for new chemicals that will not destroy the ozone layer. And eventually, we're confident they'll be able to find chemicals and substitute processes which are not toxic as well. If we didn't start the process by restricting the ozone-depleting chemicals, we know one thing for sure, we would eventually cause a skin cancer epidemic. So that's one direction we certainly had to turn away from.
And we would have a skin cancer epidemic because the CFCs create a hole in the ozone layer which lets in ultraviolet light.
Right. The CFCs destroy ozone. Ozone is the shield that protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation would have, from the sun, eventually would cause serious increases in skin cancer if the ozone layer disappeared.
Okay, well, we left off talking about the need for chemicals that would replace CFCs. Do you think that there should be any government incentives to private industry to come up with alternatives to CFCs and alternatives to other dangerous chemicals?
I think government has to create conditions which discourage industry from creating dangerous chemicals. And for instance, it's not just a matter of creating, say, some toxic substance to replace CFCs. In fact, we can learn to change the very processes that industry uses, that we use, so that we don't need as much of these chemicals of any sort. And you can recycle, for instance, some of these chemicals in order to not waste so many. A good example is the electronics industry, which uses a lot of CFCs as solvents. There's no reason that those CFCs should go up in the atmosphere after they're used. We could have nearly 100% recycling of the chemicals in that industry so that when they introduce substitutes which don't destroy the ozone layer, if they're toxic, well, if they're recycled, they don't get into the environment. So it's not just a matter of substituting one problem for another. It's eventually moving in a direction where you have fewer and fewer problems. And there the government has a very important role.
When you look at possible solutions to the greenhouse effect, how much of an emphasis do you put on lifestyle changes?
Well, I think the lifestyle issue is sort of a red herring. The way I look at it, over the next 30 or 40 years, with or without the greenhouse effect, even if there was nothing to worry about, our lifestyles would change radically anyway. If you look back to 1940, few people had cars. There were no computers. There were no lasers. So what I would like to argue is that 40 years from now, greenhouse effect or no greenhouse effect, our lifestyle would change radically anyway. The key thing, therefore, is just having a conscious public policy, as our lifestyle changes anyway, of just making sure it changes in a direction which brings us lower emissions of these greenhouse gases. And in this case, that means changing in a direction of lower energy use. And where we do use energy, it should be energy that doesn't come from fossil fuels. It should come from solar energy. We could, for example, satisfy all the needs of everyone on the face of the planet by extracting solar energy on just 1% of the desert land of the Earth. So technically, it's feasible to do without fossil fuels.
What are your priorities, both technically and in terms of lifestyle changes, for America to try to reverse the greenhouse problem?
People should first, on their own, look at the way they live and figure out how they could live just as well with just as good a lifestyle, only using less energy. And that means driving a much higher mileage car. The average new car gets 28 miles per gallon. You can get a 50 mile per gallon car. And there are prototypes which are just as comfortable as the average new car, the average of today's 28 mile per gallon car, but which get 100 miles per gallon. They're not on the market yet. If we had the demand, they would come on the market. Those cars emit one quarter of the carbon dioxide that your average new car gets. There are light bulbs, highly efficient light bulbs, that last 10 times as long as a standard incandescent bulb, use a quarter of the energy, and over their lifetime, they'll save a half a ton of carbon dioxide emission per light bulb at the power plant end of the line where the electricity is produced that they use. Everyone should be going out and buying those light bulbs. Everyone should recycle more because the use of virgin materials actually costs us a lot in terms of energy. People should plant trees because trees are not only good in their own right, they cool off your house and they remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere If your house is cooler, by the way, it means you use less air conditioning. Air conditioning, of course, uses electricity, which generates carbon dioxide. So there are lots of measures the individual can do. The government has a lot it can do, too. Government is a consumer. The federal government owns 500,000 vehicles. They should not get 28 miles per gallon. Those cars should get 50 or 60 miles per gallon at least. The government has lots of buildings. They should have the most efficient light bulbs in those buildings. The government can control the price of fossil fuels by doing things like taxing gasoline. So there are many things the government can do. There are many things individuals can do. The point is we should get off the dime instead of just talking about all these different options.
People really want American business to be competitive with other countries. What does competitive mean in terms of new technologies that are environmentally sound? And how do you think America is doing?
Just as the commercial jet plane was a spinoff of the military need for jets, and the commercial jet plane, by the way, sort of defines our whole civilization in a way. It's created this whole peripatetic culture, global markets for goods and so forth. There are defining technologies which are about to spring forth, hopefully, which will come from not military exigencies, but environmental exigencies. And I would point to solar photovoltaics, that is, solar cells, as an example. Solar cells transform sunlight directly into electricity. They were invented in the United States, but the biggest share of the global market of manufacturing these things is now with Germany and Japan. West Germany just bought our biggest solar cell producer, Arco Solar. And if things continue as they are, we're going to wind up having to buy those technologies, the solar cells, from abroad when the world eventually does inevitably move to get rid of fossil fuels in order to deal with the climate problem. So I see great opportunity in these environmentally benign technologies. I think they are the wave of the future, much as, say, jet engines and computers were the wave of the 70s and 80s. And I think that our government should get on structuring some sort of policy which would keep American industry in the business of making these kinds of technologies.
Which countries are the leaders in creating new environmental technologies?
Well, the United States has been, but it looks like, as I said, the leadership is slowly sliding to Germany and Japan, as it is in many other things. And I look for the European bloc, the European community, led by West Germany, to be the leader in developing and selling new environmental technologies over the next 20 years or so. And I see Japan as very important in that regard also. And again, if the United States takes seriously the notion that it is a big world power, the way to be a big world power in the future, both politically and economically, will be to invest in environmental technologies so that we can lead the world out of environmental problems and make money in the process.
Michael Oppenheimer is my guest, and he's a scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs a program that focuses on solutions to the greenhouse effect, and he's written a book called Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. You gave us something of a scenario before, like a worst-case scenario for the 21st century. If things were turned around, what would the scenario look like?
If we started today reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, getting rid of chlorofluorocarbons, ending deforestation, we could slow the growth of the gases in the atmosphere and eventually stabilize the situation. And I think there's a good chance it would be possible to do that with a climate that was only a couple of degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And that would be a noticeable, although modest, warming. It would probably not be disruptive. And it would mean a stable, economically viable, environmentally sound planet that we could pass on to our children. I think we can do that. I think we've got to try. If we don't start trying now, we have to remember this about this about the climate problem. The effects are irreversible. The levels of the gases in the atmosphere stay there for hundreds of years, and the worst effects come decades after the emissions. So we're banking in trouble today that we won't really see the worst of until maybe we're gone and our children have to be there to deal with it.
You know, from what you say, it sounds like scientists really don't know for sure what the effects will be.
Scientists don't know in specific what the effects will be. For instance, I can't tell you, and no scientist can, what the climate of New York City or Philadelphia or Washington will be for July of 2036. But they can tell you that if we keep emitting gases this way, it'll be much warmer. Sea level will be much higher, storm patterns will change, precipitation patterns will change, agriculture in certain areas will come under stress, that we're putting strains on civilizations which already have big enough problems. The climate problem is one they don't need. So, yeah, we can only predict the general outlines of what the future will look like, but those outlines are scary enough that we should want to stay away from them.
I think it's fair to say that the environmental movement has grown larger and more diverse than it's ever been. Could you give us your critique of what you see as the greatest strengths and weaknesses of the environmental movement today?
Well, the greatest strength is that it's a broad-based movement. Everyone's an environmentalist. World leaders from Gorbachev to Thatcher to even Bush want to proclaim themselves as environmentalists. And these issues are up in front of the public day in and day out. We've been very successful in getting them on the agenda. The greatest weakness of the environmental movement in the United States is that it is not, environment per se is not a political issue in the sense that other ones are. Since everyone's an environmentalist, so is every politician. Therefore, you rarely see politicians really forced to make decisions pro-environment or anti in a way that people can go into the voting booths and vote for or against. The public has been gulled, basically, on these issues. And part of it is their own fault. If you think about it, how many times do you go into the voting booth and pull a lever based on somebody's environmental record? Until people are willing to do that, you're going to see a lot of lip service and not much action. So I really look to Election Day, November 6th of 1990, as the next Earth Day. That's where people can prove that they really care about the environment by throwing out the rascals who don't care about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Michael Oppenheimer is senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs their Global Atmosphere Program. His new book on global warming is titled Dead Heat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.